Once again, good to be able to come together, God's people, to encourage one another, to be able to worship our God together. Be encouraged by each other. Again, I want to say that continue to appreciate all that you're doing for Jane and I and for Nancy as we deal with the situation. Just within the last couple of days, Jane has asked for some oxygen now a couple of times. I'm not sure what that means. She hasn't really used any for quite some time, so I don't know if it's something kind of temporary, maybe because of the weather change, or whether this is something that indicates a new development that will be with us now for a while. I don't know. So, again, appreciate all your prayers and your concern and all that you're doing for us. I find that a lot of times I mention Romans chapter 1 in connection with various things. The description Paul gives here, beginning in verse 18, of the degradation of the Gentiles, what happened to them as a group of people, obviously not to every one of them, but what happened to them as a group, what brought it about. And so I thought, well, we'll just do a little bit more extensive lesson on that this morning. Steps that lead to destruction. Destruction, spiritually, is a process. When an individual, a Christian, especially we think of, becomes unfaithful, it's a gradual process. We start missing them in the assembly a little bit more each time. And pretty soon, all of a sudden, we don't see them hardly at all. And it's not because there's sickness going on and things of that nature. They have decided to turn their back on God. But most people just don't do that overnight. And it's the same thing here with the fall of the Gentiles. It didn't happen overnight. There was a process that took place. I would suggest to you that we can look at it in about a four-step process. Now, unfortunately, what happened to the Gentiles is not something that's just unique to them. But it starts out with a failure to glorify God and to be thankful for God and all that He does. That's where it seems to start as Paul goes through this process for us. Then, having done that, they become vain in their reasoning. Of course, they're now depending upon themselves, and so that's going to be the result of it, vanity. Men are great in their own minds, but when you take away God's standard, their greatness all of a sudden really is not there. Then, of course, being created by God with something internal that calls out for a desire to please or to worship a higher being, they turn to worshiping idols. They can't worship God because they've turned away from Him, but there is something unique within man that is not present in the animal kingdom that drives man to think about someone or something more powerful than himself. Idolatry is the only answer they can come up with because they've rejected God. But idols don't preach morality. And ironically, the ones who generally lead in this idolatry get caught up in gross immorality in the process of worshiping their idols. They try to justify it. And so the result then is this sin-sick group of people. And that's pretty much what Paul has described here in Romans chapter 1, starting there in verse 18. And the same pathway is followed today. It's not pleasant to think about. But that's exactly what happens. When a person turns away from God, there really is no reason to remain a moral individual. Now, I'm glad that most people do, who have no interest in God. I'm glad that most of them are pretty much law-abiding people and all of that. But the fact is, there's no reason for them to be. They are. Makes for a little more orderly society. Not as orderly as it would be if they would accept who God is and obey Him, but nevertheless, a little more orderly than it would be. And the first thing Paul points out in verse 18 is that the wrath of God is against such people, as he continues to describe in this chapter. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Now this wrath, Paul says, is going to be revealed. Now the wrath of God is not a popular concept, even among religious people. They don't want to talk about that. God's a grandfather in a rocking chair handing out things to his grandkids. Nothing wrong with grandpa's handing out stuff to grandkids. But they think God's like that. That he's just some kind elderly grandfather type that, oh, would just never even hardly think a negative thought about one of his grandchildren. They don't like this concept of the wrath of God. Way back in the 1700s, some of you may have studied this character, a preacher by the name of Jonathan Edwards, not to be confused with Johnny Edwards, that some of you may know, had a sermon, famous, one of his famous ones, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Well, that's exactly what is described right here. God is angry at what these people are doing. And he has a right to be angry because, as we'll see, he revealed himself to them. But they don't accept that. They want to live without consequences. How do you deal with fornication? Abortion. That's just one example that illustrates how men look for some way to live any way they want to live, but don't talk to me about consequences. Don't talk to me about the wrath of God. I don't want to hear about it. Well, Paul talked about it. Now, this is not arbitrary on God's part or something irrational on his part. God just hasn't lost his mind and decided to, you know, I think I'm just going to punish these people. It wasn't arbitrary. Again, God was provoked into doing this. His anger was provoked because of the evil that was going on. Because they turned their back upon him and went into that downward spiral of all kinds of ungodliness. In other words, they deserve it. They have it coming to them, and only by doing that can God remain a just God. He cannot reveal himself to mankind. And over here you have people who believe in him and they follow him faithfully. Then you have this other group who don't want to have anything to do with God, and yet somehow God's not going to punish them. After sending his son into the world to die for them, he's just going to overlook it. There's not going to be any wrath of God one day poured out. That doesn't meet the test of the fact that God is a just God. So people are getting what they deserve. I think I've used this illustration before when I was teaching school. Seems like back in the dark ages now, but you'd hand back a test and the kids, some of them would have a very bad grade on it, and they'd say, Mr. Curry, you gave me an F. I said, I didn't give you an F on that paper. You earned it. I didn't give them anything. All I was doing was grading them on their effort. They didn't put forth any effort, so they didn't pass the test. These people we're talking about here are not putting forth the effort to honor God for who he is, and so there is a price to be paid. God's wrath is going to be shown against man's ungodliness and unrighteousness. They may try to justify it any way they want to, but it's not going to do any good. Not going to work. Now, Paul says that these evil men, here in verse 18, suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Boy, we have got a lot of suppression of truth going on out there today. We're more and more living in a culture and in a country where the people who are advocating gross immorality are becoming less and less tolerant of any other viewpoint. I saw a guy interviewed on the news the other day who got shouted down and had some kind of substance thrown on him, turned out to be harmless, some kind of lavender oil or something, but I mean, he didn't know that when they sprayed it on him or threw it on him. You say, well, what outrageous subject on that college campus was he talking about that provoked such a reaction? His basic theme was, men and women are not the same. You can't even talk about men and women being different now. Come on. And you dare not get into a lecture on morality and condemn homosexuality and things of that nature. Don't you do that. We don't want to hear that. We're not going to let you express your viewpoint. What about the First Amendment right to free speech? You don't have it anymore, so shut up. That's where we are as a culture. You know, it used to be if somebody looked at the title of a lecture and they didn't agree with it, they just didn't go to it. You know, nobody forces them to. That's not enough anymore. They're going to suppress the truth. They do not want the truth to even be talked about. But, unfortunately, there's going to be an end to that. The Lord Jesus will be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and obey not the gospel of Christ. What awaits them? Everlasting destruction, Paul said. But that's the wrath of God. And people can deny it if they want to, but it's going to take place. Now, the next point Paul makes here in the next couple of verses is that the truth about God has been revealed. We can't literally see God because God is a spirit. But we can see the evidence of his existence. And the more that we look at the world around us, we begin to see these invisible attributes of God. His omniscience, his omnipresence, his omnipotence. I mean, how else can we explain this? We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a little bit. Creation is the proof of God's existence, and especially the complexity of creation. You've got to be out of your mind to believe that. For example, they say the eye is one of the most complex parts of our human body. You got to be completely out of your mind to believe that that just kind of evolved. I mean, you got to be out of your mind to believe anything evolved, but something that complex just sort of happened on its own? Give me a break. And that's why God is just in bringing forth his wrath, because he has provided this information about his existence. It demands intelligence. What we see around us just didn't happen. And God's power then is seen in what has been created. There are several things that have never been disproven. An axiom is a statement. Hasn't been disproven yet. Anything that is made demands a maker. Can anybody disprove that? A design demands a designer, and a building demands a builder. Those three, you have to accept those. An axiom is something you accept as the foundation of something maybe more than that. It's a starting point. You cannot deny any of those three statements. Just can't happen. Everybody knows that. And everybody accepts that, except when it comes to the things we're talking about. If you showed them a watch and they said, "Where did you get that?" "I found it out on the road." "Really? You found it on the road?" "Yeah, just like that." "Oh, somebody must have left it there, dropped it, lost it." No, there was a box of watch parts over beside it. And what I figure happened is when that box fell out of the airplane, somehow or other, when it hit the ground, it formed itself into a watch. It's an old illustration, but it's true. It works. That's why it's a good illustration. Nobody would believe that, and they shouldn't. But yet they believe the universe just happened. No, there's a reason they don't want to believe it. The universe is screaming at us to believe there is a God. The 19th Psalm talks about evidence for creation, and then also talks about the will of God, as we find out not only there is a God, but what He wants us to do. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, nor their words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, their utterances to the end of the world. In them He has placed a tent for the sun. And it goes on and on and on. The universe is screaming at us, "Look at me and know there is a God." But yet men don't want to believe that. And Paul says they are without excuse. Their attitude is, though, "You haven't convinced me there is a God. Therefore, the proof of God's existence is lacking." Reminds me of that Russian cosmonaut a long time ago. Come back from outer space and declared there is no God. On the basis of what did he make that declaration? Well, he didn't see him. He'd been out there in space, never saw God, so he concluded there is no God. Foolish. Of course, that's a communistic, atheistic nation. What would you expect? But Paul says there is sufficient evidence. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. No one can say to God on the day of judgment, who is condemned to torment, "I don't deserve to go there. How was I supposed to know you existed?" You lived in God's world every day. That's how you're supposed to know. But verse 21 says, they didn't honor him as God. Again, it wasn't because there was not enough evidence. It wasn't because they couldn't know whether there was a God. They knew, Paul said. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Paul said so. That's how I know that these people he's describing knew who God was. They chose not to honor him. The evidence was there. They chose not to honor God for who he is. Belief leads to a need to obey. Psalms 10 and verse 4. The wicked in their haughtiness of his countenance does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Notice, who is he talking about? The wicked in their haughtiness, their pride, will not allow themselves to submit to God. So all they think about is, there is no God. There's no God. I can do this. Sadly, they'll find out one day that's not so. They failed to glorify him as God. That's our very purpose for existing, folks, to glorify God. Why are we here? To bring glory to God as our Creator. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20, you've been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. It's amazing that the only part of God's creation that doesn't understand and doesn't glorify God, I should say it that way, that doesn't reflect, let's put it that way, their maker, is mankind. That's because we have a choice. Every animal ever created, every plant for that matter, reflects the glory of God. Solomon in all of his glory, remember that? Not arrayed like one of these. Jesus talked about the birds of the heaven. They all bring glory to their Maker by doing what they were designed to do. Even though we get aggravated at them sometime. Some situations, you know, we wonder, well, why did God design it that way? Why did he design woodpeckers to make so much noise when they're going about their work? But when you hear that woodpecker up there on that tree or up on that pole, whatever it is he's pecking on, you know what he's doing? He's bringing glory to his Maker because he's doing what he was designed to do. We don't always do what we're designed to do. That's pretty sad because we're the rational, spiritual part of God's creation. They don't have a soul or spirit. Now, we can either deny or glorify God on our based on our works. It'll be one or the other. Titus chapter 1 and verse 16 talks about the first one. They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. Paul's in the context there of some false teachers. They're not glorifying God. They're actually denying God. Now, Peter in chapter 4 of 1 Peter, verses 10 and 11, says each has received a spiritual gift, a special gift rather, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Whoever speaks, let him speak as it were the utterances of God. Whoever serves, let him do so by the strength which God supplies, so that in all things, watch this, God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. That, again, comes back to why we're here, to glorify God. They failed to honor God. They failed to glorify God. They were not thankful. James tells us the source of all of our blessings. Where does he say it is? James 1, verse 17. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down to the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation or shifting shadow. God is there. God is a constant in our life if we wanted to be there, and we need to be thankful for that. As Colossians 3, 15 also talks about, and be thankful. And express this thanksgiving. Hebrews 13, 15. Through him then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of our lips that give thanks to his name. Be thankful. Look at all he has done. Yes, there's adversity. Yes, there are things that come into our life that we would just as soon not have to deal with. But we're to be thankful for God to all that he does do for us. See how then great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason the world does not know us because it did not know him. 1 John 3:1. Be thankful. They became futile in their thinking. Their hearts were darkened. Their reasoning becomes futile. Because their premise is false. The premise of those who turn away from God is that, after all, I don't need God anyway. I can do it myself. But Jeremiah wrote what? The way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. But the philosophy of men comes along and says, you can do it on your own. You can figure it all out by yourself. You don't need God, and you don't need his word. And it wouldn't be so bad if they stopped right there. But they go on to say, if you do turn to God, and if you do try to live by his word, that's your problem. That's your problem. What are they afraid of? Why do they suppress the teaching of creation? Or even several years ago, they come up with the intelligent design movement. Why can't we teach children that there was an intelligent designer? No. Can't do that. Can't teach religion in the schools. I mean, they even took God out of it and just argued for an intelligent being of some kind. That's not even acceptable. Because that goes against their whole thinking that we don't need God. We can do it on our own. We don't need it. They abhor the light. As I said a while ago, that phrase, suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, that fits right in with that. They don't want to come to light. Jesus, why don't people come to the light? Why aren't people willing to examine what they believe? Why aren't they willing to defend what they believe? Jesus said it's because their deeds are evil. That's why. This is the judgment, that light has come into the world and men love darkness rather than light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light, does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. We should not be ashamed of anyone ever questioning what we believe. We should look forward to it. But people over here in darkness, they don't want that. They're not going to have any examination of what they're doing because they know they're wrong. They're just not naive in their positions. They are wrong and they know they're wrong and they don't care. And they don't want us to talk about it. We're warned in a lot of different places, I just put a couple here, about the philosophies of men. But here's one of them in Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. See to it no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the traditions of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. Knowledge falsely so-called, Paul said in 1 Timothy 6:20. They don't have the knowledge, they just think they do. And they are not willing to listen to anything else. Their minds are closed. And what's next? The only thing that can happen. When you have this view of God, and when you decide you don't need God, as I said, there's only one way to go. Idols in place of God. The foolishness of idolatry. You remember back there in Isaiah, 44th chapter, as Isaiah was rebuking God's people, by the way, for their idolatry. He talks about the fashioning of an idol. And they go out into the woods, you see, and they get this log. And they shape it. They measure everything out, and they make it in the form of a man, like the beauty of man, so that he may sit in a house. Down in verse 15. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. So he cuts out this log, and he takes part of it, makes an idol, and the other part he throws on the fire to keep warm. You know, my question is, how does he know which side to get rid of? Maybe he put his idol in the fire. I mean, that's the whole point of this. It's a very sarcastic view and description of idolatry. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and said, deliver me, for thou art my God. Maybe he used the wrong half. It's futile. We can be idolaters, by the way, without bowing down. Ephesians 5:5 talks about covetousness. That's the same thing as idolatry. They worship the creature rather than the creator. They exalt man. This is exactly what is really coming to fruition in our country, not just here, but other parts of the world too. These old isms of men are really coming to the forefront as more and more people have abandoned God and have no interest in knowing about what the Bible says. They are turning to all of these other isms, among them humanism, where man becomes the measure of all things. Not God, not his word, man sets the standard. Theologically, humanism is the tenet that denies the divinity of Christ. In humanism, there is no God. Obviously, then Christ cannot be the divine Son of God. In the realm of ethics, it's the doctrine that man's obligations are limited to and dependent alone on man and human relations. The doctrine that man's nature is perfectible through his own efforts without divine grace. In other words, mankind can improve themselves morally without God. Now, where has that ever happened? Without any evidence and influence of God, what society has ever lifted themselves up out of the cesspool of immorality? The answer to that is there aren't any. They just go further and further downhill. Don't need God. We got ourselves. We're smart enough. Who needs God? Pretty sad. Pretty sad. And people go for advice to people with a long string of degrees behind their name who believe this right here. Many of the counselors and psychiatrists that are out there in the world are humanists. They don't advertise it, but they don't believe in God. They reject His word, and they sit there and act like, based on their own intelligence, they're going to help people. They're not going to help them right. I guarantee you that. I debated a man one time who was a preacher and a slash psychologist, but more of a psychologist, who said man was in darkness until the time of Freud. I mentioned that before. You believe that? We couldn't deal with human relations until Sigmund Freud came into the world? Give me a break. Psychiatrists don't even buy into some of his stuff anymore. Unbelievable that a gospel preacher would say such a thing as that. Finally, what did Paul say happened? They are abandoned by God. But notice how it starts out there. Just as they did not, therefore God gave them over in the lust of their heart to impunity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. They rejected God. They didn't want to know God. And so God turned them over to this debased way of life. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. That's homosexuality. It's a debasement of man's purpose. I don't care what any politician says or any preacher says. Paul was an inspired man, and that's what he wrote about homosexuality. It's not only sinful, it is described as unnatural. I heard the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, the other day say that if he's a homosexual, he said, if there had been a pill I could take so that I would not be a homosexual, I would have taken that pill. And he went on to blame God for being a homosexual. I was made that way by my Creator, he said. No, you were not, sir. You were not. You turned to that debased lifestyle. That's what Paul said. What can we expect? If we teach our young people they're nothing but animals, having evolved over these millions of years from lower primates, from monkeys, we shouldn't be surprised if they begin to live like animals. And that's exactly what's happened in our culture, getting more debased all the time. Paul says also here that they are receiving in themselves the penalty of error which was due them, the consequences of immorality, diseases, unwanted children. Well, wait a minute, we get rid of them by aborting them. Right, that's how they deal with that. They reap the consequences of what they have sown. God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And same way also men abandoned the natural function of the woman, burned in their desire toward one another, men with men, committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. They're reaping the consequences. They've been abandoned, they know they're wrong, and they sin anyway. And then verses 28 to 32, which we will not take time to go through in detail. Don't have time for that. But this is what happened. This is the kind of stuff they get involved in doing. And not only do they do such things, Paul says, knowing that those things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. They cheer other people on when they're sinning. That's sick, sin sick, and a depraved way of looking at things. The consequence of willful sin is not good. Under the old law, the writer of Hebrews says they died at the hands of witnesses for committing willful sin. There are sins committed in ignorance, but most of what people do wrong, they know it's wrong when they're doing it. If we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin. It's that serious. Well, the steps of digression are pretty easy to see. That's what happens. The thing to do is to avoid that first step. That first step was what? Refusing to honor God and to glorify God. Turning away from God. Let's avoid that. Let's retain a knowledge of God in our lives. If you're here this morning, subject to this opportunity, this invitation, we give you the opportunity. You may have many others. Hopefully you will if you choose to ignore this one. But you may not. Nobody knows. And so use this opportunity to become a child of God by becoming obedient to the gospel of Christ, being buried in water for the remission of your sin because you believe in Jesus, because you've repented of your sins, you confessed your faith. We'll do that for you. And if you've done that and you need to come back to God, please let us know as we stand and we sing together.